Hello and welcome to Real Talk. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and this is the show that explores questions large and small. For the month of March, which is Women's History Month, we're hosting Real Talk Unleashed. Today, I welcome three learned women to our studio on Vashon Highway. They are producer-director Zane Jones. Welcome, Zane.
Hi, thank you.
Journalist Christina George. Welcome, Christina.
Hi, Susan.
And activist Tanya Kinnear. She is our thought leader for today's topic. In fact, we are doing four topics this month. This is our second topic. Last week, we covered... What did we cover last week?
Gender identity.
Gender identity. That's right. How quickly we forget. Tanya's topic this week is raising kids with life skills for the future. Welcome, Tanya.
Thank you. So it's great to be here. So one of the conversations I'm currently interested in is with regards to our children's future and how we as parents and educators are preparing them. What are our children going to need to navigate an uncertain future? As we are aware at the moment, I think most of us, the climate is facing a crisis, and the impacts could include everything from extreme temperatures to technology with artificial intelligence, which is going to increasingly take over our lives. And this leads me to wonder what skills as parents we can impart to our children that will assist them in learning a coping strategy for what lies ahead. I think as parents, we tend to live vicariously through our children. We see their success as our success, their failure as our failure. And as a result, we often end up imprinting our fears and expectations onto them, which in turn can interfere with their ability to realize success on their own terms.
Yep.
Children are much stronger, I believe, and more capable than we realize. Last summer, there was a letter in the Beachcomber from a fourth grader, which really impressed me. And I quote, "I say, stop kid-proofing the island because people keep taking away stuff that kids love and are perfectly capable of playing on safely by themselves. For example, at the farmer's market, they cut down the bottom branches of the climbing tree, which all the kids loved, making it impossible to even get a foot off the ground. Recently, an expert said that there was a choking hazard at the top of the old slide at Ober Park, and that the slide didn't meet the newer fall ratings. So for these reasons, they tore it down and replaced it with a $12,000 short plastic tube slide. Couldn't the old one be fixed for less money? Hey, I'm a kid, and I love that slide. Sure, I've skinned my knees a few times, but it never killed anyone. And fall ratings? The whole point is to take a risk. If there are any kids out there reading this, then I hope you agree. I stand for the fact that kids can take care of themselves," which is written by 9-year-old Isabella Piani. So I think we also tend to show love by obsessing over our children's happiness. But do we help them understand the world and how to live in it, to persevere, to fail and keep going, to overcome adversity, connect with others, and find their path to live the best life they can? Isn't that love, too? Do we help our children understand that failure is part of the journey to success? Or do we try to prevent our children from feeling those emotions instead? Many times, we reward our children even when they don't complete the task. Recently, there was an article about a teacher in Florida who was fired for giving a zero mark to a student who actually didn't do their homework. The parent-teacher handbook stated that the lowest grade to be given was 50%. So what happens when children are rewarded for an incomplete task? The result is that completion is now no longer necessary, or alternatively, they're more than aware that they didn't deserve the reward as they didn't complete the task. And what does that do to a young brain? It's confusing, to say the least. Then there's technology. Every day we observe babies in strollers on smartphones at IKEA, airports, malls, and restaurants. I've actually observed that a lot, which indicates...
A lot of restaurants with that happening.
Yeah, and IKEA, I look down an entire line of people behind me, and every single one... Children, babies, adults were on their cell phones. Nobody was talking. So This indicates our children are gaining knowledge from animation, especially little ones, because they're watching animation on their phones, instead of observing their actual environment and testing their abilities as a way of learning. I've had conversations with teachers regarding the fact that they have to constantly ask their students to switch off their phones. How do we even allow cell phones at school is my response to that. They are a serious addiction and distraction from the business of learning. The brain is constantly being triggered to respond to the next like or statement on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. So our students are no longer present in the classroom and focusing on learning the skills necessary.
And I think I've read somewhere, too, that parents who work in the tech industry were actually very adamant about not allowing their kids to use tablets and, you know, like that sort of.
And restrict themselves, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to say that's something that we definitely struggle with in my household. I mean, my kids are 9, 12, and 15. And the screen time, it's hard. I have been one of those parents in the grocery store where I need my child to be quiet, so I've handed them a phone. Mm-hmm. I get what you're saying, because it's so easy to just go over the top, and you know, it makes it easier for your as a parent, right? Well, short term,
right?
But
but then it becomes an addiction, mm-hmm. and so it's no longer just a choice anymore. I can't think, I can't be aware of what's going on around me or listen, because I'm thinking about whether I've got another tweet or a like. The other thing is, do we as parents try too hard to protect our children from the consequences of their actions? Often parents intercede when their children are confronted with their negative behavior or failure in an attempt to circumvent or reduce the ramifications and impact that it could have on them. The emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, is funneling our children into jobs and possible success in a very narrow area. For some children, this is fine. However, what about those who want to pursue other careers? When I grew up, we learned, and I'm old, so anyway, we learned.
That's a relative statement. <but.
laughs> We learned how to make clothes. We read stories. We drew pictures. We took photographs. We built model airplanes and ships. So we worked in the garden. We cooked food. We explored the outdoors to go camping. And this gave us a much broader experience in basic life skills, opening up other alternatives.
Well, we do have these occasional power outages here on Vashon. So
Maybe we should have more.
Yeah. Which has given us a self or a imposed tech thing, which is usually 2 days of listening to my kids just complain about how horrible their lives are because they can't use the computer. And then usually on day three, they start finding other things to do and like talking to each other,
right?
Playing some board games.
Yeah, board games are great. Oh, that's the other thing we used to do. Sundays we used to sit down and play Risk and board games. That was great. So it's becoming increasingly clear that the future, I think, of the planet and our existence on it is going to be compromised somewhat. And all our lives are going to go through some radical changes. That's a given. Along with the change will come many challenges that we've not experienced before. And this will require a skill set that our children and grandchildren will have to acquire. And so, to quote David Attenborough, no one will protect what they don't care about, and no one will care about what they have never experienced.
Oh, ouch.
And so, with that, I can open up.
Well, when I hear you talking about particularly technology, it seems to me that we are just taking one step after another to disconnect ourselves from human contact, human interaction. And that's the people on their phones in the store, the kids on their phones in the store. You're right. They're not experiencing their immediate environment. And it seems to me they are then dependent on that technology, not just for information, but for life skills. That's where they're learning about life skills, from animation.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's terrifying.
And it's interesting, really, isn't it? It is a big subject, and thanks for all that you just brought to us. It's really compelling, and I'm not a parent, but I certainly have young people in my life, and I work with young people as a teacher every day, or not every day, but often. But I do certainly think that, as you're saying, Susan, that there is, it's a problem, or it's certainly concerning. And if I think about just even the cell phone, just texting, let alone everything else, you know, social media and so forth, but just texting, when it first started happening, I remember being like at a dinner with someone and they would get a text and then they would keep talking and they would get another text. It's like having a, you know, at first, now we just take it for granted, but at first it felt very upsetting.
Rude.
It's, yes, right. And rude. And, to, yeah. You know, and now it's just like totally acceptable, right? To me and everyone else. And so to be, mm-hmm. and I didn't grow up, we didn't, none of us at this table
none
grew up
did.
With that.
Right.
So that's a really interesting, and I don't want to demonize the whole thing, you know, technology necessarily, but mm-hmm. it's really changing how we operate in the world and how we communicate and how we don't communicate. We're communicating somewhere else. And of course, it's limited. I had a student, I'll just finish with this for now, but this student yeah. recently who said to me, hey, you know what? I've been experimenting with turning my phone off, not just silencing it or turning it off and putting it away for the entire day at school.
Huh.
Because mm-hmm. I find that I take this break from my phone to have class. And then I'm like, as soon as we have a break, I'm right. And all my students do it.
Huh.
At break, yeah. they're all on their phones checking their emails, and they don't. And it's like, it's so quiet on the breaks. Mm-hmm. It used to be that people, you know,
people were talking
talk.
To each
yeah.
other.
Yeah. yeah, they don't. So anyway, there's that.
Yeah, and I also notice when teenagers or even some middle school, elementary kids, when there's phones involved, they get together mm-hmm. and they're all on phones. I mean, they're all together, but they're not talking to each other. I mean, and I've asked my kids about this. I'm like, you know, let's. Can't you, isn't that kind of weird? I mean, have you looked at somebody in the eye and talked to them? And they're like, well, yeah, mom, but I don't know. It's just easier. Like I don't want to call them. I'll text them, but I don't want to call them. And I have to say that I used to be on the phone a lot and I used to love talking on the phone with people. I also like very rarely, unless it's my mom, I rarely get on the phone, or if I'll text somebody and say, are you available for a call? I don't know if it's, I mean, that's kind of weird, right? I mean, and I think it was better to be able to just pick up and talk. I mean, maybe I'm an anomaly.
No, but I think that's true. I have you know? Two friends who I make myself, they're elsewhere. I have, mm-hmm. I call them like at least a couple times a week and we talk on the phone just to keep those friendships yeah. alive.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. very different, right?
Mm-hmm. Those it phones. Is.
But then sometimes I'll FaceTime with people that I wouldn't talk to on the phone, which makes like no sense. But.
Well, no, then you get to look at them, especially yeah. if they're far away.
But you know, yeah, I guess so.
And you
well,
get
FaceTime,
body
so.
Language then. When mm-hmm. you're watching mm-hmm. people, you're yeah. reading body language
that's
as
true.
Well. And when right. you're texting, that you can't, that there's no yeah. way to kind of get that kind of connection yeah. with people. Whereas when you're talking mm-hmm. to them, you can hear the intonation in their voice. The yeah. tone of their voice, and it gives you some, it's an emotional connection, not just a written connection.
And I think yeah. you're right that there's something changing for sure about individuals' ability to cope and deal with life in its fullest sense.
Yes.
That involves all that you just mentioned. In other words, if a lot of my communicating is happening through this device that's only this big, you know, it's small, mm-hmm. this screen. And it's with somebody who's not even here, yeah. you know, they're somewhere else and it's just these little, well then, you know, what is it then to be in the presence of someone who's got a lot of energy, a lot going on, things are happening, maybe there's conflict, maybe there's just excitement. And I wonder often in my work anyway with young people, if a lot of this anxiety disorders and anxiety attacks and all this stuff, maybe there's certainly environmental issues, I'm sure, chemicals, who knows what else in our environment that are at play. But I also wonder about this conditioning. You know, that life is just becoming, when you're talking about life skills, that life is becoming in its fullest sense, like it's overwhelming.
It's almost artificial. It's almost yeah. as though kids, all of us in this world of technological communication have a barrier up to emotional interaction or to conversation that allows for give and take. Mm-hmm. Rather than a text that kind of dumps what you think and then another text that kind of dumps back what they think. And then
right.
you get exhausted mm-hmm. because you're trying to have a conversation with your thumbs. It is this barrier to mm-hmm. emotional interaction.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we actually do get with people, the expectation is that they're just going to be nice.
And I think that's, you know, there's a wonderful theater practitioner. Her name is Ann Bogart. She works out east, but she talks about that Americans have this aversion to disagreement. You know, she's talking about creative collaboration.
Absolutely.
They think that collaboration is all about agreeing. Mm-hmm. And she said, actually, I would say that collaboration is a lot about disagreeing.
Exactly.
And navigating that. Mm-hmm. And we all know that's challenging and difficult. But where do you learn those skills if you're not engaged in dealing with human beings one-on-one in the midst of taking on something that's really difficult, mm-hmm. whether it's a work project or an artistic project or a personal relationship? Intimacy, you know, it is a challenging
I think a lot of that is fear-based, because I know coming from the UK, I have come from a different culture. I've come from a different culture, and I feel that there I'm much more able to be me, and well, cause I'm English, but I mean, but also I'm much more, I'm not uncomfortable saying what I really think, whereas here I feel I have to think about everything before I open my mouth. A lot of times, sometimes I don't, and it's a mistake. But, you know, I feel a lot of times that there, you know, there are certain requirements in this country as to how we, what we can talk about and what we can't talk about.
Yeah. And I wonder about the role that online engagement and communication plays in that too, in terms of just this kind, like commenting on social media, for instance, or the engagement. You know, it escalates so quickly. Mm-hmm. There's an anonymity to it sometimes. Mm-hmm. You can just throw out, people can just throw out a comment that's really argumentative. You know, there's a release there. But in life, we don't do that. Yeah.
And they don't experience the consequences of their action.
Right.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of room for nuance or long explanations of detail in those responses. You know?
You are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, here with my colleagues Tanya Kinnear, Zane Jones, and Christina George. This is Real Talk Unleashed. We're talking about raising kids with life skills for the future, and we can do this thanks to the generosity of Windermere Vashon Real Estate. They support all our community information programming, and they make our emergency alert service possible. Find them on the web at WindermereVashon.com.
Another question I have is, I'm curious, should we be having more honest, open conversations about the possible challenge ahead for our children and allow them to express their thoughts and work through their feelings? Or are we better off just not telling them anything?
What do you mean?
Well, in terms of the idea that there are going to be some struggles ahead. I think we know that. I mean, that's the truth. So should we try and help them prepare for that a little bit?
Yeah.
I mean, not so we want to terrify them. And, you know, I think it's a very fine line between giving them information so they feel that maybe they can do something and be a part of the solution rather than kind of protect them from it.
You know, I was just thinking about this incident in a Chicago suburb last year. There was this 8-year-old girl who had a dog, and she would walk her dog around the block, safe neighborhood, and by herself. And there was a neighbor who called the police saying that there was a neglected child, unsupervised, walking the dog. So the police came to the mother's house, and fortunately, you know, there was some reason involved, and they took a look and said, okay, well, this is not a problem. But I just thought, wow. I mean, and that's not the first time that I've heard stories like that, because in our old neighborhood in Chicago, there were kids that would walk home from school on their own. And then there were other people that felt that was not something they should be doing. So they would call the cops, or the kids would be playing in the park by themselves or with other kids. And I'm talking about places that a reasonable person would say this is an okay place for people to be. But there's really kind of like, I think that, you know, for as a community, that there's a real split between, I would hope that everybody would want independence for their kids, but there's so much fear involved. Yeah. And also feel like a responsibility that people sometimes feel that they have to get involved in. So I just wanted to bring that up because I kind of feel like on Vashon, one thing I really like here is I feel like for kids, they're able to get out and explore. I mean, for my kids, they can ride their bike through the woods to the friend's house, or like there's a lot more freedom for them. And I think that would help build resilience. yeah, for kids. Definitely.
Confidence. It helps to build confidence.
Yeah.
There are kind of two issues in that example for mm-hmm. me that you gave us in Chicago. And one is, gosh, yes, kids need to learn to be independent. They need to learn that, well, you are walking and it's a relatively safe place, but don't talk to strangers and be aware, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And you're capable of caring for yourself enough to be safe. The other is the idea of the perversion of the village. If a parent sees a kid doing something they think is not safe, why do they call the police and not the kid's parent?
Right.
Exactly.
Why not exactly. become, I mean, that's another thing.
Well, usually they just post it on Facebook and yeah. complain yeah. about it.
Right. Ridicule, yeah. ridicule and judgment, but yeah. not cooperation, mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. a village caring for the kids. That's not about the kids.
Mm-hmm. No.
That's about somebody wanting to tattle.
And again, I think that you brought that up in your, you know, your intro for today too. It seems to me this kind of overprotecting, this protecting our children from life, and we become the police people of everyone else's children mm-hmm. too, because it mm-hmm. taps into this kind of self-righteous kind of know-it-all-y aspect of our humanity that's not very constructive for anyone. Mm-hmm.
You know. And the sort of the freedom aspect. I have a yeah. story of when I was about 6 and my brother was 5.5 years older than me, and we were in Scotland in a village, kind of rural, and one day he decided we were going to go to this place called Tea Leaf Bay, which we used to go and visit. And I was on a tricycle and he was on a bicycle, and we rode, and it's about 5 miles.
Wow.
And I was on this rusty
That's
old
a long
tricycle.
Oh, right.
It's all day, right? And we got there, and then we picked blackberries because there were blackberries everywhere, which, again, everybody hates blackberries. I love blackberries.
I anyway. Love them too.
And we picked them, and we didn't have anything to put them in except my bonnet, which I was wearing, and my knickers. So they filled my knickers and my bonnet with blackberries and put them on the handlebars. And my parents suddenly showed up, and my brother had told my mother what we were doing, but she obviously thought, yeah, right. And so they showed up, and they came to and put me in the car, and my mother took me home, and then my father walked with the tricycle and my brother and his bicycle all the way home.
Ooh.
And but you know, that was sort of the thing. We used to take off all the time and go down to the River Forth and mm-hmm. climb around in the mud, and I mean,
and
kayaks.
You had experience.
We used to mm-hmm. climb up to the top of the roof, which was 3 stories, you know. We did all sorts of things that kids just never do now.
No,
ever.
Right.
And it sounds horrific, but we learned a lot.
Exactly. You learn what you're made of when you take risks and overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they don't go so well. It's rare that that kid risks, reasonable kid risks, result in death.
Isabella said.
Exactly. When I was a kid, so they break an arm.
Yeah.
It happens.
Right.
When I was a kid, we did that too. We took off in the morning and came back at night. One time I got in trouble and went into a house that was under construction with my friend, and we were experimenting to see how heavy the wallboarding was. Well, when we pulled it out, turns out it was 1,200 pounds. It fell on top of us.
Oh.
He broke his arm. I broke my leg. We were okay. I mean, we learned, oh, that stuff is heavy.
Bones
Don't
break.
Do that again.
Maybe we shouldn't go into houses under construction.
Yeah. So you learned from it.
Right. Mm-hmm. I learned from it. And when I raised my kids in the 70s, I was a single mom. I couldn't hover over them. I had to teach them what they needed to know and trust that they were smart enough to pay attention and to act accordingly. And they did.
I wonder, too, in terms of that question you're asking about, you know, do we tell, you know, how much do we tell young people and how much do we just leave for them to figure out on their own or whatever? And I wonder, too, about, you know, in the line of work I do with teaching, we talk in terms of modeling professional best practices in our teaching. And I wonder about, you know, modeling not just as parents, but as adults in the world amongst younger people, whether they're our children or not, you know, modeling core values, you know, and am I present in the world? Am I engaged? Am I mm-hmm. showing up? Am I willing to hold space for all that humanity is? Like, you lose your temper, okay. Or there's bad, you know, there's some behavior that's difficult to deal with, okay. We don't have to have a grudge. We don't have to move each other out of town. As a friend of mine used to say, you know,
yeah.
you can mend fences. You can know that human mm-hmm. beings experience difficulties sometimes, and also they come together and have wonderful bonds that can form. And so I wonder sometimes in our own lives, or I just think about that for sure, that we can model kind of best practices in terms of communication, you know, with young people too. And this presence thing, I think, is key.
And I like that question, Tanya, about what do we tell them about what might be coming in the future? What are you going to need to know? Yeah. We don't know, but right. We know here's what might happen. And you need to be aware, and you need to be learning what you can along the way, mm-hmm. so you're ready to do your part. And I think that's important, too. I don't think kids get the sense that their behavior or who they are has an impact on what's around them when they're shielded by this technological wall. And I think when people have no sense of their impact on others, then they don't care what they do. They become self-centered and or in some cases criminal because they don't see their own impact and they don't see their own value as human beings.
And don't understand the consequences. And,
exactly.
And you learn from failure. I mean, failure is amazing because if you either say, okay, that's not for me, or I'm going to try harder and get there. So, you know, learning persistence, I think, is huge.
You know, one thing I wonder about sometimes are with those kids who are really sensitive, am I helping them by, like, how do I help this sensitive kid in developing grit? You know, like, I was reading about this orchid, they called it orchid children. Have you heard about this?
No. No.
It's a Swedish term. So there's, you're an orchid or you're a dandelion. So, you know, the orchids need a very special environment to thrive, while the dandelions can thrive anywhere. And there was a pediatrician, his name is Thomas Boyce, and he has a book, it's called The Orchid and the Dandelion, Why Some Children Struggle and How All Can Thrive. But he had an interview last week and it had me thinking about, you know, like, one of my kids is very resilient and I can say, don't do that, sit down, I told you to stop, and they're fine. But my other one, if I do that, this child will just totally break down in tears, like, oh, you know, this sobbing. And then sometimes the sobbing, I'm like, okay, I just want them to stop crying. So then maybe I'm appeasing them by, you know, giving them what, I know I'm not, you don't give them what they want because they're sobbing, but I think it's a real challenge for parents. When you have a sensitive kid, like, how do you help build the same grit in those kids?
Or? I don't know, but maybe by asking them how they're feeling and having mm-hmm. conversations about that as a beginning in terms of how they see and how it impacts them, and maybe helping them to come up with ways in which they can, mm-hmm. You know, be less fearful or, I mean, there are some things you can't change. Yeah. Obviously.
Yeah.
But just, I think maybe by communicating and finding out where they're at and trying to help them navigate, if you can, to learning those skills.
Sorry,
go ahead.
No, I think that, you know, because I work with young actors all the time and have for a long time, teenagers and young adults. And one of the things we try to do with acting class, which I think is really helpful for all people, is this creating space for, like, if they get moved to tears or they're very sensitive and things happen, you know, to just say, okay, I don't have to make a big deal of it. Mm-hmm. I don't have to fix it.
Right.
You know what I mean? But to create that space where you get to be, okay, you get to feel your feelings.
Yeah.
And we'll continue on.
So kind of let them get it out.
Let them, yeah.
And then give them some time and...
Yeah. Shocking, but we're out of time. Speaking of time, we've just run out of time. You've been listening to Real Talk. This is Real Talk Unleashed. Tanya Kinnear was our thought leader today with information and discussion about teaching kids life skills for the future. What a complicated issue that is. Zane Jones, I want to thank you for being here.
Thank
Christina
you.
George. And thank you all for listening.